The question was what to do about bad songs running through one's head. And I always appreciate and always suggest when somebody is asking a question like that, that you not say which song. Because it can be quite contagious, and that everyone else ends up kind of seething at some point or another, like, why did they put that song in my head? Okay, we don't want to know. Thank you. Well, like any unwelcome experience, there's just a certain level of understanding, or, bless you, or insight that helps in that we actually can't control what will arise in our minds. And what we're trying to do is develop a certain relationship to these things, so we're neither consumed by them nor struggling against them, resenting them and hating them. And so it's really like just taking that general understanding and applying it to this situation. Sometimes what you have to do in that specific situation is actually consciously move your attention elsewhere, not hatefully, like, oh my God, you know, it's this terrible song. But, you know, to be aware of it a little bit in as balanced a way as you can, and then consciously move your attention elsewhere, especially something bigger. Like, just listen to sound in general, you know, if you can, or feel your whole body, something like that. And just keep moving back and forth with all of that. It definitely happens, you know. Now we all want to know what song, right? Secretly wishing.
I'm sure everybody's already found out.
Ooh. That's true. Everybody has their own bad song. Anybody else?
I wonder if you could comment on the relationship between the focus on the breath in this meditation and the focus on the breath in Lamaze for childbirth.
Do we have a mother here? The question was about the relationship between focus on the breath in this meditation and the focus on the breath in doing something like Lamaze, breathing in childbirth. And I don't know. So
it's a long time ago. But the focus in Lamaze is to focus on something other than what is arising so that you are intent on that and not consumed with what really is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When we sit with breath, we sit with all that arises.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the comment was that in Lamaze, the purpose of it is to have an object that one could be with that will take you away from what is happening most predominantly, which are the sensations. And so in a way, it's like to not be with what is. And here, the breath is like a foundation for being able to be with what is, you know, to be able to open to it more completely. And this won't perhaps answer your question, you know, precisely, but there are many ways of meditating, obviously, you know, and there are many methods, there are many techniques, and even something like being with the breath can be done in a lot of different ways within the meditative world. And this comes down to what, you know, we often talk about, and many of you, I'm sure, are very familiar with, which is a distinction between practicing meditation in such a way so that your primary interest is the deepening of concentration, or practicing meditation so that your primary interest is the emerging of wisdom or insight. And it's not that these are mutually exclusive. They totally support one another. but it's almost like a question of emphasis. So there are many, many ways of practicing concentration, where basically we choose an object. It could be the breath, it could be a mantra, it could be an image. They say the Buddha taught 40 objects of concentration, and that, of course, is not a complete list, but they were the main ones. And if that's the particular style of meditation you're exploring, in a particular period of time, you gather all of your attention around that object, whatever it is, and when you realize your attention's gone somewhere else, as quickly as you can, you just bring it back. And you just keep bringing it back and bringing it back, and over a period of time, there gets to be a kind of steadiness in the attention. And what we experience subjectively is like being centered. They say that, this is kind of a side note, there's a word in Pali, the language of the original Buddhist texts, klesa, which is very, you know, like a very old-fashioned translation of that is defilement. A more accurate translation of that is torment of the mind. You know, the understanding being that when we are consumed with jealousy or fear or anger or greed, that we're actually, it's a very tormented state. So it's said that when we deepen concentration, when we get that much steadier kind of sense of centeredness, what is dissolved is sort of the obsessive nature of the defilements. You know, it's like they might come, but we're not like glomming onto them. We're not, you know, falling into them so completely. We're not being so overcome by them, because it's like having a sense of being centered. And then the wildest kind of thing can come up, but we're, you know, we're, it's like we've established a base of steadfastness. So one of the things the force of concentration does is keep us from being just so overcome by these states as they happen. And then, you know, as we often talk about, the energy that's brought together with the force of concentration is a huge amount of energy. You know, so it's really an extraordinary state to be strongly concentrated. And then the other emphasis in meditation practice, or a whole stream of meditation practices, might start that way, you know, but then say something comes up that is really strong, you know, powerful sensation of pain or memory or an emotion. Rather than trying to let go of it right away and coming back to the object of concentration, that new thing becomes the new object of meditation. And so we're with it, and we're doing our best to be with it in a different way. You know, not struggling against it, not adding on to it, like, oh, what's this going to feel like tomorrow? You know, not judging it, like, oh, I shouldn't have this happening, you know, like, you know, I've been working on my anger for 43 years, you know, why is it still here? You know, so it's being with what has come up that is now predominant, you know, that's really captured our attention away from the breath or whatever it was that was our object of concentration. And we try to relate to it in a way that's different from our ordinary way of relationship, which has so much to do with holding on and pushing away and not liking and manipulating and all of that, because it's believed that if we can relate to these experiences differently, we have the opportunity to really learn deeply about them, about ourselves, about the nature of things. You know, so a very fundamental Buddhist perspective, at any rate, would be that everything arises is changing. You know, and so much that comes up we take to be solid and real and permanent, but when we really look at it, we see, ooh, it's moving, it's changing. You know, so it's a very different perspective on our experience. So, you know, the breath, as is commonly used in this system, is not so much really for the sake of that kind of absorbed concentration to hold all of our attention, although we do some of that. It's more to have a base of awareness to develop enough concentration so that we can look at everything that comes up, and all of our experiences become part of the meditative process.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to figure out how do I know if I've developed enough concentration so that it's calming to let something else predominate.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like if I've done that, pretty soon I'm all over the map.
Mm-hmm. So the question was, how does one know if we've developed enough concentration to allow something else to predominate? Because very often in doing that, you know, then it's a slippery slope, in effect. You know, then we're just all over the map. In a way, it's really just seeing if something is predominating. You know, we don't have that much choice. If you feel something come up quite strongly and you make a little bit of effort to be with the breath, but you feel that pull, you don't want to be in conflict, you know, and sitting there thinking, oh, damn it, you know, I can't concentrate, this thing is so strong. It's much better to just be with it. And if you find that that is not occasionally, but commonly, very commonly, leading you to a state of being distracted, then you might try to use a tool like mental noting. So, you know, you're actually naming in a simple way the object that's happening, because then it's not quite so captivating, you know, that you're able to say, oh, planning, which... It's almost like that utilizes some of the mental energy, channels some of the mental energy that would otherwise go into like, well, I better get gas before I, you know, get to that mall, because if I don't get gas then, you know, then I'm going to end up not, you know, not being able to do that, and then, oh, I better, you know. So it's like, oh, planning, you know, would be a way of keeping some of the steadfastness of the concentration. Somebody here had a... Did you see it?
Well, I kind of had the same question, but since you've answered it that far, then my question is, if the whatever is coming up very strongly then becomes the object of my meditation, it can be really strong. And I'm wondering, kind of, sometimes I'm not sure then what to focus on, like the bodily sensation, or noticing, oh, suffering, or trying to have some insight into the situation just feels like, oh, I just get caught in the thoughts, so that doesn't, trying to have insight doesn't really work. So, just wondering about a little more suggestion about mm-hmm. how to work with that when it's really mm-hmm. strong, what to focus on.
Okay, so the question was, something comes up that's really strong, which aspect of it do you try to be attentive to? And also the side note, I think you're quite correct, trying to have an insight about it doesn't work very often, because we just spin out, you know, in some way, commonly. Not always, you know, but often the insights that come most often are sort of intuitive. They just come, not because we're probing and trying to figure out something. Because I think when we are with an experience and in effect we're kind of quiet with it, we've created some space, and out of that space, insight, creativity, realization, seeing connections, you know, seeing patterns, seeing relationships, all kinds of things will come. But it comes out of this space. Whatever we're paying attention to, you know, some complex thing arises which has emotional levels and physical levels and memory, or, you know, anticipation, or all kinds of things. no matter what we're paying attention to, it's also a good idea just to keep coming back to the breath now and then. It's like I often think of the breath in that style of meditation as being a place where we recalibrate. It's almost like we re-enter a state of balance. It's like, oh yeah. You know, because we're just letting the breath be however it is. We're letting it change however it changes. If we're balanced with the breath, it's not like we have this stranglehold on the breath, you know. And we're also not leaning forward to get ready for the next 50 breaths. You know, there's a kind of balance right there. And so, you know, you've got this really intense thing going on, it sounds like, you know. So, you know, pretty frequently just kind of come back to the breath, even if it's for one or two breaths. Because it like reminds us in a very visceral level, oh, this is what balance feels like. You know, and then maybe we're drawn to that experience again. It's okay. You know, then you just come back. Which aspect to be aware of? It's kind of hard to say. You could say, some teachers would say whichever part is most intense. Because to do other than that is going to set up some kind of tension. Other teachers I've heard really emphasize the sensations in the body. Because this is sort of grounding for us. You know, as our minds spin out into what's it going to feel like next year, or this only came because I should have been able to stop this, or whatever we may be spinning out into, it's the sensations in the body that help us just be with what is. It's like I used this example when I was teaching this past weekend, so several of you have heard it very recently. Others of you have heard it long ago. But I was sitting myself at the Insight Meditation Society, which I helped establish, and it's in Massachusetts. And one of my teachers from India, this man named Manindra, was there. And I was going through just this very uncomfortable and unwelcome period of anger. And it was just coming up a lot, and I was quite disgruntled, you know, that it was there. So I said something in, I'm sure, a rather complaining way to Manindra about the anger, and he said, okay, this is how you should be with your anger. He said, imagine a spaceship has landed on the front lawn, and these Martians come out, and they come up to you, and they say, what is anger? What is anger? He said, that's how you should be with your anger. Not, it's right, it's wrong, you know, how triumphant, I've got to extend this, or I hate this, I can't believe I'm still angry. Not, you know, if only I hadn't, or, you know, or can you believe they, you know, just like, what is anger? What is this? So the first place we go to help us in that exploration is the body. You know, what does it feel like? What does anger feel like? And then, you know, you just kind of look at how anger is functioning without a judgment, without trying to stop it, and also without getting lost in it. Now, this is, of course, easier said than done, you know, but it's tremendously freeing. Because then whatever is coming up in our practice is a part of that practice. And you just, you know, explore, experiment with different tools. Like mental noting is one tool. You know, if you're saying, oh, anger. That helps often, you know, not being so consumed with the 50th plan of revenge, you know, that's coming up. It's just like, oh, this is anger. It helps point one, okay, this is anger. This is, what does it feel like? What is anger? And then, of course, what we see the particular nature, we see that kind of burning, we see, there's a word often associated in the Buddhist psychology with anger, which is persecution, that I like a lot, because what I have seen, like in those times of looking at anger, is its narrowness. You know, how options cease to exist, how Or the example, you know, I've been using is like if you're really angry at yourself, the 50 great things you did today, gone. You know, it's like there's this narrowness, you know, this tightness. I am the idiot, you know, who said that. And then we see that it's, you know, so first we see it's kind of immediate nature, and then we see in truth anger is not just one thing. I mean, this is the same thing with pain, actually. It's not just one thing, you know, it's moments of helplessness and moments of fear and moments of sadness and, you know, moments of rage, and it's really an alive system. All these things are coming and going and coming and going. And so beginning with just feeling the anger, we can have a very deep, deep insight into the changing nature of everything. You know, it seems so solid and so unyielding on one level, but when we really look, it's movement. That's what it is. And so even that, you know, in the conventional sense, unwelcome feeling can be very onward leading. And so, you know, so that's how we really do it.
I just read the Ikamah book, and I was curious about how to look at discipline and loving kindness in practice, because I seem to go into polarity around that.
So the, you mean particularly in relationship to her and how she was?
It seemed like she embodied something about don't stop there, and I love every second of this. So like, I was like, wow.
Mm-hmm. The question was about, the comment was about one of my teachers was this woman named Deepa Ma, and someone has written a book kind of compiling her life story. What's it called, actually? Called Deepa Ma, yeah. This is the second version of it. The first one was called Knee Deep in Grace, and I can never remember what they called it, so Deepa Ma is quite appropriate. It's simple. And the author, the woman who put it together, is named Amy Schmidt. And she was a very, very special woman. So then the question is, in many ways, Deepa Ma embodied both loving kindness and discipline. And so what is the relationship between those two? She really was a very special person. She had an extraordinarily difficult life, I think, by anyone's standards, you know, in certain periods of her life, and a lot of sorrow and grief and heartache, and began her meditation practice at that time, you know, with a lot of loss, just immediately following a lot of loss. And she was living in Burma because her husband, who was one of the people who died, had been in the Indian civil service. And so they were living in Burma, and upon his death, she basically just went into a state of collapse, and she went to bed, you know, with a heart condition for like a year or something like that. And then 5 years? And then there's a doctor who came and said, if you don't do something about your mind, you'll actually die of a broken heart. He said, you should learn how to meditate. Because this is Burma, after all, you know. So she did. And they say that when she went to the monastery, she was so weak that she actually had to crawl up the temple stairs in order to get into the meditation room. But she emerged, you know, from that period of meditation with some amount of peace of mind. And it translated in her life to being phenomenally loving. You know, she was a tremendously loving, loving person in a very personal way. You would always be, we would go to see her, and, you know, she would cook, or she would make sure we had tea, or, you know, it was very, very caring and very personal. And I saw her meet many, many people, many kinds of people. And I never saw her kind of reject anybody or have a wall or a barrier between herself and anybody else, whoever they were. You know, there was always something very inclusive and nurturing and loving about her. And she was very strong. You know, I think the loving kindness came certainly out of her own intense experiences of suffering, and that deep, deep knowledge that none of us is immune. You know, that you could just go along in your life and then one phone call and it's a different life. You know, and that we all share that, and that there's this huge kind of heartful space that acknowledged all of our vulnerability and cared about everybody. So the loving kindness was very strong. And also, as is often the case, and you know, we know that, just from life, our own lives or friends or somebody, sometimes when you've lost so much, you really understand what's important and what's not important. And she had a tremendous kind of discipline and demand around that. You know, when she came to IMS, to the Insight Meditation Society, at one point, several points, and she taught there. And when you sat with her, there were no naps, you know. Like other teachers, either there was like a nice little padded period after lunch and nobody had to know if you were napping or not, or they actually didn't care if you were napping or not in that period. But with her, it was like, we're going for it, you know? We're just like, keep going. A lot of discipline. But I think, maybe in reference to your question, there's certain assumptions about one's psychology that I think are in play when things like right effort are talked about. Like that kind of wholehearted, complete, putting oneself into a process, nothing held back, is not that easy if the whole time you're doing that, you're thinking, I can't do it. I'm not good enough. I can't, you know, I can't accomplish anything. Other people can do this. This isn't going to work. I can't do it right. You know, that's a very different component. I'm not having the right experience. You know, why aren't I sitting here in bliss like everyone else? And, you know, why, you know, it's like, and, you know, so many of us bring that kind of thing, that kind of pattern to the process. Or if, in the example I used over the weekend, you know, there's a balance that's always talked about in effort. Because if you try too hard and you get really uptight, it's not going to accomplish anything. And yet to have the steadfastness and the willingness to really be persevering is not that easy either, you know. So there's the middle way right there. You can't, nothing much will happen if we give nothing much to the process. But it needs to be right, you know, it needs to be balanced. And so the example which I use this weekend is the very classic example of the Buddha talking to this monk who, before he became a monk, had been a lute player. And the monk was trying way too hard in his meditation. He was doing walking meditation, and apparently there was a kind of ferocity in his walking, and it was like way too tight. And so the Buddha said to him, well, remember that time before you became a monk when you were a lute player, and when you were tuning your instrument, if you made the string too tight, what happened? And the monk said, well, it was the wrong sound. And then the Buddha said, well, what happened if the string was too loose? And he said, well, it was the wrong sound. And the Buddha said, ah, just so, you know. It needs to be right in the middle there. You know, not trying way too hard. And so these things are challenging for us. And it's a whole process and exploration. You know, what is right effort, I think, is a long, long, long exploration. And it's always changing. Because sometimes we're in one, you know, sometimes we're tying the string, tuning the string too tight. Sometimes it's too loose. And, you know, so it's a profound question. And yet, I think we can, personally, each one of us, keep finding balance, you know, within that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's like, I can have an argument with somebody and can work up a big story. And if this has been a common story, you know, when I investigate, I know that it's going to come and go, and we open this, and things will go on. But I wonder, a bit afterwards, should I have dealt with it at the story level? Should have, like, I come up with ideas, well, I need to do this this time for sure. This has happened before. And I wonder what type of balance to draw between.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the question was between was about balance in another dimension, which is like, if something comes up that's like a real life incident of, say, conflict or something, and we can deal with it on the meditative level and just see the story dissolve and see the actual experience of, say, the sensations or the emotions dissolve and then deal with it that way, or there's another level of making a decision about, say, communication or remedying something or realizing that this situation has happened before and that maybe we should do something about it, and where's the balance with those? And, you know, I mean, I think that's kind of an intuitive balance. I don't think those two things negate one another. One of the things that I found useful about sitting with the incident or the issue is that I can get so much more clarity about what I'm actually feeling, not just on the surface, but layer under layer under layer. I can also get a lot of clarity, which is essential, about what is motivating me to act. You know, do I want revenge? Do I want to be seen as right? Do I want to actually change the situation? Would that be enough without the rush of being seen as right, you know, or the feeling of revenge? You know, and it's just like, it's almost like this tableau is laid out in front of us, and we really get to see what could be our motivation for taking action. And then, of course, once we see, we have some options, you know, to maybe come from a different place in what we, you know, do or say. If we've seen that whole range of emotion and not just the topmost level, we also have some options in terms of what we wish to communicate, you know, depending on the nature of the understanding or what we want to see come out of the situation. It's like when I was here in April for Seeds of Compassion, and in one of the sessions, the Dalai Lama amused me greatly because he was saying something that I felt could come out of any communications coach in California. You know, he was basically saying you should use I language. You know, the way he put it was something like, you know, it's maybe not so correct to say it's hot in the room because maybe not everybody's feeling hot. It's better to say, I'm feeling hot. And I thought, who's he been talking to, you know? That's so cool. But, you know, that's basically a skill, you know, to not kind of And I realized, you know, when he said that, and, you know, as I've heard this, you know, of course, before, but I thought, you know, there's a lot to that, because if somebody said something to me like, that was a great movie, and I didn't find it so great, I would feel kind of dominated and a little bit crushed, you know? Whereas if they said, I thought that was a great movie, there would be some space for me to say, well, I actually had this problem with it or something, you know, so that's like a real communication compared to somebody defining the absolute truth. And so, and within that, what I meant by the level of, you know, relationship one wants is like, if one is very angry, but as you look into the anger, you see layers of yearning, unfulfilled expectation, desire, you know, is that the level you want to communicate? I mean, that's honest, you know? Sometimes it's more truthful than just that flash of anger. And that's a decision we can make, depending on the situation, you know? You know, what do we want to communicate and at which level? So I think the things we learn and the things we see and just being with the situation, they're useful, actually, in the realm of taking action and, you know, whatever we decide to do with that. Yeah.
If you were in peril of becoming so desirously attached to a former experience that you had where you really felt like you had sort of a window into the subconscious, what kind of techniques or path would you suggest for in meditation trying to go back to that moment? Or would you at all?
The question was about, I'll paraphrase, you know, about having a kind of profound experience of feeling like one has a window into the unconscious in meditation and then being attached to that. So basically, how do you get back there? You know, or would you at all try? That also depends, you know. If you're going to try, I certainly wouldn't do it from a place of attachment. You know, and this goes back a little bit to what I was saying when I was drawing a little bit of that distinction between, and this is not easy, you know, because they're not so totally separate at all, but they are distinct in some ways, you know, that way of practice that primarily focuses on deepening concentration and the way of practice that is more open to the many things that come and go. And of course we do a blend, but many experiences arise through a great strength of concentration. Whether you're particularly practicing to have greater concentration or it's a natural trait, or, you know, even in doing a more open meditation, you're deepening a lot of concentration. Many of the actual experiences that we have are born out of a certain strength of concentration. And concentration as a factor of mind tends to be somewhat fragile. It's like we all know it's easier to concentrate in a quiet place than in a noisy place. And we might set the stage, you know, and take the phone off the hook and, you know, do these different things. Not that that many phones have hooks anymore. But, you know, I was with Sylvia Borstein, one of my colleagues, one of my friends. We were at this conference and there's a young woman from Europe there. And some of the presenters at the conference had been speaking like rapid fire, and Sylvia, we were at lunch together, and Sylvia said, that's like it was like hearing him, I don't even remember anymore, 70, what is it, 72, 78 RPMs? So Sylvia said, that's like hearing them at 78 RPMs, and the young woman from Europe had no idea what she was talking about. So I said, do you know what she's talking about? She said, no, and I said, well, with record albums, and she said, oh, the thing you need the machine for? You know, those big round things? And I said, yeah. You know, so that's what I felt like. Take the phone off the hook. Anyway, so, I mean, certainly we can try to set the stage to have as much quiet as we can, and sometimes we succeed and sometimes we don't. But there are things we can do to try to enhance concentration, and that's, in a way, like the root of that kind of experience. If we get attached to a certain state, we're sunk. You know, because maybe we can create as much quiet as possible, and you sit down and you're all composed and everything is fine, and then you have some memory, you know, that comes unbidden, is very unpleasant. You feel like you were just on the verge of this extraordinary state, and it's gone. And that's why, for the sake of freedom, we might utilize ways of deepening concentration and work with them, but not with attachment. Because from the point of view of insight meditation, we can be aware, we can be mindful of that very, very deepening quiet. We can be mindful of the sound or the memory that's interrupting us. We can be mindful of the agitation. We can be mindful of the annoyance. We can be mindful of the regret. And all of that is part of the meditative process. You know, it's not like the meditation ended when the memory came. You know, because we're working with having a balanced awareness of all of that. So it's almost like you can utilize the technology of concentration to deepen it, and you can. But you never know. You just never know. It's not a controllable phenomenon. And so another whole way of approaching practice is to just work with what happens in as complete a way as possible. You don't see where that takes you. It's hot, huh? Yes? I'm feeling hot. And I correct myself.
We could open the doors, but then that can hear you as well.
Yeah.
So recently I was with a loved one in the hospital with an emergency. I had a feeling of really helplessness and powerlessness. And mindfulness wasn't able to make contact with it. It was just, you know, go over and reactivity. So I don't usually lead with metta, but I decided to metta, and it allowed me to make contact with, you know, with the moment. So uh-huh. You can speak about metta in those extreme.
So the question was about being in a situation feeling helplessness and powerlessness, and mindfulness as a quality didn't seem to be able to make contact with it, but loving kindness could. What's the relationship of loving kindness in kind of extreme states. And it's funny, I was just talking to somebody about loving kindness, and I said, sometimes I find it's the kind of thing I do or others do when we actually don't know what else to do. You know, there are many situations in life where we don't know what to do. You know, somebody's suffering, or it feels overwhelming, or and we can't, despite all of our conditioning about being in control, we can't figure out the lever, you know, to actually bring us into control and make something change radically or quickly or on our timetable or whatever it is. And I find that loving kindness, which is basically not trying to interfere in a situation, but just like kind of saying, "Oh yeah, you know, may you be happy, or may I be happy, or may we be happy, or may there be peace," you know, something like that, helps create space that is also in relationship. You know, it's also having that kind of connection, but it's different from what we're conditioned to, you know, from what that habit is. And I've just seen myself and know other people that use that kind of practice in those ways. And I think it's actually very meaningful because I think, again, you know, it has to do with what can emerge when we're not doing the things we might ordinarily do, like try to fix something very quickly. And sometimes something quite wonderful or healing can emerge when there's spaciousness and in its own time, too. You know, not as we necessarily would like it to emerge. Does that make any sense? You know, so I was just thinking of being in hospitals with people. Seeing sometimes, you know, that as, well, it's like, even like I saw Ram Dass not too long after he had a stroke. And, you know, everybody who was reaching out to him was doing it from a place of such tremendous love and care. But it's like the amount of, like, herbal remedies he got, you know. And then his attendant pulled out, like, this bottle of Ganges water from the refrigerator, which he was supposed to drink. I said, don't drink it. Whatever you do, you're going to get cholera, you know. Don't drink it. And it's like, and it's not like, I mean, every single one of them might have been useful. But in those days, because everyone else was panicked, you know, it was almost like there was a kind of pressure. And he needed a little more space right then. You know, for all I know, I mean, he's so much better. For all I know, he did drink the Ganges water, you know, and it made him better. So it wasn't like any of those interventions were off, you know. Every one of them might have been useful, but it was just the kind of insistence, and he was like a little too shaky, you know, he was a little too vulnerable right then, and he needed like, more like just companionship and presence of people and loving kindness, and, you know, over time, a little Ganges water, you know, or whatever. And so I feel like I learned a lot from that, and that loving kindness does create a kind of connection out of which different things could be explored or looked at, and it's just different. Yeah. Yeah.
Sharon, could you share a story or two about your process of the Developing Faith, the book, and
what that arose? My process of developing faith, the book. The first book that I wrote was Loving Kindness, and that was also a process that came out in 1995, I think. And all my life, from the time I'd been a child, I'd wanted to be a writer, and I, you know, never felt I could. And there was always this long period after I started teaching, which was in 1976, where, you know, all of my colleagues were writing books and all these books were coming out, and and all these people started saying to me, well, when are you going to write a book? And then I finally did, because I'd been teaching loving kindness meditation. It was so meaningful to me. So, I finally put out that book, and that was really great. And then, a friend of mine who was also an author said to me, what do you do when your first book expresses your life's work and you want to keep writing? And I said, I guess you go deeper. So I looked deeper and I saw this very strong interest in the quality of faith and what that might mean, what it had meant for me, and, you know, misunderstandings and confusions around that word. And I developed a very strong, I don't know what the word is actually, compulsion, something. I needed to write that book. And that continued through publishers not wanting to publish it and, you know, people saying it was the wrong thing and no one would understand it and why don't you write another loving kindness? And, you know, I mean, there was a lot there, but somehow within it I felt this very strong urge, you know, to write the book, and finally it all came together and, you know, and it happened, and I think I've written two books at least on kindness since, you know. But that one, you know, of course stands out, you know, as what it is. Yeah. What about faith? Well, you know, when I look deeper, that's really what I saw. It was just a you know, when I would do loving kindness practice, when any of us do loving kindness practice, even when we do mindfulness practice, there is so much that we don't know at the time. And yet we're giving our hearts over to it. You know, when I say to people, in doing loving kindness practice, don't get hung up on what you're feeling. You know, if you don't feel a great wave of extraordinary bliss, if you can't say, well, at, you know, 8 p.m. I finally loved myself completely, but keep going. What has us keep going? You know, there's something that deep within us recognizes something, even if we don't have immediate results and there's not a sense of triumph and we feel like there's so much we don't know, and, you know, still there's something we do know. And so, you know, I think it sort of, it started with my looking at loving kindness and saying, okay, what's deeper? And I realized that to do a practice, we are expressing a lot about faith, you know, not in the dogmatic sense or the doctrinaire sense, but being able to come forward and being open and taking some risks and being willing to try without having such a total sense of like, yes, I got it, you know, I got it today, you know, who knows what glory tomorrow will bring. And, you know, so I think we all are really manifesting a very great deal of faith. But it's a word that's so unpopular that I thought, okay, you know, I'll give it a shot. So we were talking before the class, and I said I went to Boulder in May and read the book, so it's going to have an audio life for the first time. But in the nouveau world in which we live, it's only going to be a digital download. That'll happen, you know, soon. Yeah.
My question is sort of a faith and practice question, so maybe I should just read your book, which I haven't read that one yet. But over the course of practicing for several years, I feel that I've been able to recognize what a lot of my mental habits are, especially the negative mental habits, and yet I still feel that they have such a hold on me. And at times, the Vipassana approach feels too passive, and I feel that is there some more active effort, some more active way that I could be rooting out these destructive patterns? You know, should I explore cognitive therapy, which I've never done before? And I do suspect that a lot of it is faith in the power of awareness. But any words of encouragement?
So the question was, after some period of practice now, still seeing the hold of destructive emotions, and wondering if awareness, basically, is awareness enough, or are there some other things to do, like maybe cognitive therapy or something that would loosen the grip. In terms of that specific question, a lot, I think, depends on how much you're suffering. You know, there's nothing wrong with, I mean, we are whole beings, you know, and if something's really causing a lot of suffering, I think it, out of the greatest love and compassion for ourselves, it behooves us to look at different things, you know, and to explore different tools. I mean, why not? You know, of course, one's motivation is very important. If there's a kind of frantic effort, that's probably not going to work either. But most people, I would almost be willing to say everybody, tends to experience progress in the path in a pretty gradual way, so, and yet very real way, so that if you see the same old emotion and it's being provoked by the same little thing, and yet, you know, causing this really giant emotion that's quite painful to arise, what we usually can't see very easily, but is there to be seen, is that that emotion is not actually overcoming us for as long as it used to. You know, so if it used to just be defining us for a whole day and now it's lasting half a day, that's pretty good, actually, you know. But it's a half a day that feels pretty crummy. So most people don't say, well, look at that, isn't that interesting? This used to last all day, you know. Mostly we're quite upset. Oh, it's the same pattern. It's coming up just as strongly. It's still overpowering me. It's the same little dwippy provocation that's causing it. And yet the change from a full day to half a day is a very big change in the quality of our lives, you know, and it will continue. So whatever else one does, there is a process definitely going on. And if we look in the right places, we'll see that. We'll definitely see that. But it's hard to remember to look in the right places. And even then, you know, I also talked about this weekend, even in that half a day, it's not solid. You know, it's like we're there, and then we've got some space, and then we're lost, and then we've got some space, and then we're lost, and then we've got some space. And those moments when we have some space, they count too. You know, it's not just the other moments. You know, and that's sort of the process. It's like what once seemed just so completely solid gets, it's revealed as a, being a little more porous than that, you know, and so it continues on.
Do you have suggestions for relaxing in the body, not being so caught up in the agitation of the tension and the pain, you know, of the just sitting, what comes up as you're sitting?
The question was about relaxing in one's body and not being so caught up in the kind of tension and the pain and the agitation. Well, some of that, too, I think, is knowledge that it will come up. You know, my teacher Manindra used to say something like, well, how come you all can sit in the movie theater, you know, for hours on end, but you can't sit here and... You know, and some of that is, I mean, there are many levels of that sort of discomfort that come up. One of which is just that we tend to hold a lot of tension. And when we stop and pay attention, instead of, you know, get distracted all over the place, it reveals itself. And so, you know, people feel like, whoa, you know, that's a lot. But the revelation is a good thing. You know, it's not a bad thing. So to understand that is a good thing. You know, that, of course, you know, we're generally speaking fairly unconscious throughout the day, and that it just accumulates. And then when we stop, it's like all these people who will say, you know, it was like the first day of my vacation when I got the cold, you know. And I was going like a mad person before then, just, you know, and then, oh, yeah, now I'm sick because I stopped. you know, so we stop and then we realize there's all this agitation and so on. So it's not unnatural, it's not wrong, it's not like a bad sign, you know, that you've failed or anything like that. It's almost kind of inevitable. And that helps, you know, in doing that. And then it's mostly, you know, techniques of, as always, we look for what we might be adding on to something that's uncomfortable. Like sometimes if we have an uncomfortable sensation somewhere in our bodies, the whole rest of our body tightens up as though to ward it off, you know, so we're just adding tension to discomfort. And if you can realize that, you can just take a deep breath and relax. Any kind of practice that will help create more sense of spaciousness is really good. Just like listen to sound. You know, something like that, that isn't so pinpointed, but just like really open up your field of awareness. And then take something of an interest in the experience, you know, like trace it. See what's going on. Like, what is tension? You know? You know, what's actually happening there? And, you know, and again, it's like layers and layers and layers and layers, and it's kind of fascinating. In and of itself. So it's mostly stuff like that. Yeah.
Having come out of the retreat, you know, and then the whole semester and being about that, and then being in the silence and coming out of it, the whole negativity of the is so apparent. That, you know, I want to come out and think, oh, you know, I'm going to speak together, you know, the whole feeling quite rejuvenated and clean, and then you get this from somebody or something. And I was surprised and I got a little discouraged about my, how quickly my anger came up. And it was like, because I was more appalled, it seemed, than not quite.
So the question was about leaving a situation like a retreat where you're maybe silent and experiencing a kind of purity, and then going back out into the world and having negativity come at you and finding maybe some degree of anger coming up that didn't seem to be there before. Like, what do you do with that? Well, there are actually different possibilities. Like, is it actually so the anger wasn't there before? You know, maybe not. Maybe it was there before. It's hard to say. But in many cases, you know, the more sensitive we get, the more we do see how we've been, but maybe have been cut off from in a conscious way, and that's been accumulating too. You know, and now we have the opportunity to more see the wave. It's like the story I tell sometimes about marching up to my first meditation teacher, who's a man named Goenka, and saying to him, I never used to be an angry person before I started to meditate. You know, thereby laying blame where I felt it belonged, which was on him. You know? And of course, later I could see, well, yeah, I had been quite angry, you know, but I didn't know it. So that's just one possibility. Or it may be that you're just more sensitive. You know, leaving a retreat is a little like culture shock. Just like going into retreats a little like culture shock. And we, you know, we can get quite sensitive and things can be jarring and, but ultimately, whatever it is, you know, the question is not so much how to keep from getting angry, but how to work with the anger, you know, in that moment. You know, whatever, its source is, the arising of the anger is not so much the issue compared to how we relate to it. you know, does the anger come and is it the prelude to a long, long, long period of judgment? I shouldn't have gotten angry. I can't believe I got angry. I spent 2 days in retreat. You know, what kind of person am I? It's like, you know, this isn't going to, you know. Or do we kind of see it as a response in the moment, you know, without adding on all of that judgment? Do we add a great amount of future projection? I'm always going to be, I am such an angry person and I'm always going to be an angry person. This is just how it is. Well, it can be painful, but also illuminating to see things, you know, anew. And it's hard to say, you know, there's so many different situations. But, I mean, there are some situations in which the problem is not the negativity coming towards us, but the way we take it to heart, you know. And then there are other situations where we might need to take a good look and say, well, is this really going to be okay, you know, to be in this kind of situation? You know, it's not so easy to say, but for the first, you know, when it's a question of how we take it to heart, I come back to that story I told I think over the weekend where I talked about the Buddha being reviled and yelled at by this farmer, you know, and who, I think he didn't like the Buddha walking across his land or something like that. And as the story goes, the Buddha said, well, if somebody were to like hand you a gift and you refused to take it, what would happen? And the man said, well, then it would remain with the giver. And the Buddha said, just so, I'm refusing to take the gift of your anger and your abuse and your negativity and so on. It's going to remain with you. You know, so that's a possibility, you know, in some situations. You know, in other situations, I think it takes a great deal of discernment to see if some change might be wise, you know, in fact. So, okay. Thank you very much. Be happy. Maybe very, very happy.